of some of the things that we have talked about in the past that lead us to an investigation or an inspection of the Jonestown particulars in the first place. Everybody, well, not everybody, but most people, of course, are familiar with the basic story of Jonestown, of Jim Jones supposedly being a charismatic leader who led a bunch of black followers down into Guyana, a tiny, tiny country up on the northern coast of South America, and setting up a sort of a government in exile, a country in exile, and he and his followers setting up their own little society, and complaints about Jonestown filtering back to the United States government. And since most of the people in Jonestown were United States citizens, Congressman Leo Ryan, who represented a district right here in the area in San Mateo, where many of the constituents of Jonestown came from, was sent down on a fact-finding mission. He got down there, had a rather inconclusive meeting with Jones. Apparently, this is all the official story so far, was told that there were people who wanted to leave. There's some question as to whether or not Ryan actually agreed to take some people out. But when Ryan's group went back to the Port Kaituma airstrip, they were attacked by people from Jonestown. Among them, allegedly, a man named Larry Layton, who we're going to be hearing about later. Several people were shot. Leo Ryan was one of them and died. And then Jones exhorted his followers to follow him into suicide because now their perfect Eden had been breached and they were going to be dragged back to slavery. Now, that's the official story. And several people basically have used Jonestown as an illustration of all kinds of things. Among other things, you know, there's the danger of religious cults and people following these insane charismatic leaders. Now, of course, the question that is most important for our purposes was Jones purely a charismatic lunatic who happened to drag a bunch of people off into the jungle, or, as other people have insinuated, for reasons that we'll explain in just a moment, was Jones, in fact, working on a hidden agenda, and whose hidden agenda might it have been?
Well, one of the theories that has been advanced, and there's a great deal of evidence to support it at this point, is that Jim Jones' agenda was essentially drawn up for him by one aspect or another of the U.S. national security establishment. A number of different federal agencies and organizations have been connected in one way or another with Jonestown, notably the Central Intelligence Agency, and also perhaps also the United States Army and some of its most prestigious and strategic research facilities. Specifically, as far as CIA goes, some of the names you want to know are George Philip Blakey, who essentially was a fellow who had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in Angola on behalf of the UNITAL organization in Angola. Now, George Philip Blakey put down the original $650,000 down deposit on the territory of the People's Temple in Guyana. Okay. Now, this fellow, George Philip Blakey, is married to a woman named Debbie Layton Blakey. Now, Debbie Layton Blakey is the brother of Larry Layton Jr. Larry Layton was the fellow who allegedly led the Port Kaituma firing squad, which executed former U.S. Congressman Leo Ryan and a number of other people. Now, his father, Lawrence Layton Sr., as well as his mother, Lisa Layton, were members of the People's Temple also. Now, Larry Layton Sr., George Philip Blakey is married to Debbie Layton Blakey, the brother of Larry Layton or Lawrence Layton Jr. Okay, George Philip Blakey works for CIA in UNITAL. Also present at the Jonestown Massacre, was a fellow named Richard Dwyer, who was CIA chief of mission in Guyana. And on that famous tape of Jim Jones exhorting his followers during the massacre, Jim Jones can be heard saying, "Get Dwyer out of here." Okay? Now, Lawrence Layton Sr., the father of Larry Layton Jr. and Debbie Layton Blakey, he's a very interesting fellow, and we're going to talk about him in just a minute. Among the many things that he was involved with was he was in charge of research and development for the U.S. Army's Chemical and Biological Warfare Program at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. Now, an interesting thing about Congressman Leo Ryan was that he was the co-author of the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, and what that had done was to oblige the Central Intelligence Agency to give Congress prior notification of impending covert action. And this amendment brought the Angola operation on behalf of UNITA to a halt. And of course, recall that George Philip Blakey was part of that operation. There's also an interesting connection to Jonestown, a woman who basically was killed in a very suspicious automobile accident, had her passport given to the only witness to link James, well, basically a witness who could discredit the only witness to link James Earl Ray to the place where he supposedly assassinated Martin Luther King from. And that woman would have been down. Her name was Grace Stevens or Grace Walden, depending on whether you use her married name. She was a common law wife of Charles Q. Stevens, the only person to link James Earl Ray to the place where he supposedly assassinated Martin Luther King. Worth noting also that the Jonestown massacre totally diverted attention away from the House Select Committee on Assassinations hearings about Jonestown. Okay, so these are some of the intelligence connections with regard to Jonestown. There are others, and we speculated about the possibility of a connection between a project to experiment and use psychosurgery on prisoners at Nike missile sites in Southern California. It was basically to an institute to be set up in conjunction with UCLA for the study and prevention of violent behavior. And we speculated that perhaps that had the frustration of that project had given rise to Jonestown. And again, Niptuck referred to Mae Brussel, whose work is carried twice a week on the station, Sunday mornings at 10 and Wednesday evenings at 10. And Mae was not only the first person to talk about mind control, but was the first person also to break the Jonestown connection. And she also did a lot of work on the proposed UCLA Institute for the Study and Prevention of Violent Behavior. Now, the Layton family, as I said, is a very, very interesting bunch of people. And we're going to cover some of the connections of Lawrence Layton Sr. Now, recall how involved the Laytons were with Jonestown. Larry Layton Jr. leads the Port Kaituma Airstrip Massacre, which kills Leo Ryan, among others. His sister is married to George Philip Blakey, the CIA agent who put down the original down payment on Jonestown, on the Guyana property down there. And the mother, Lisa Layton, is also a member of People's Temple. And the father, Lawrence Layton Sr., was a member of People's Temple and is perhaps the single most important figure in this entire story. Now, in just a second, Niptuck's going to read you an interesting piece of background about Lawrence Layton Sr. It's going to come from an interesting book called In My Father's House. Now, this is the story of the Layton family and the Reverend Jim Jones. It has two authors, Min S. Yee, and Thomas N. Layton, L-A-Y-T-O-N, who is the son of Lawrence Layton Sr., the brother of Larry Layton Jr. Okay? And this book was published in softcover by Berkeley Books and was copyrighted in, 1981, okay? Min Yee, Thomas Layton, In My Father's House.
Okay, now the first is a very short segment. The significance of this, at least the possible significance of this, will be explained in a moment. The family they're going to refer to is the Philip family. Now the Philip family, Philip is the maiden name of Lisa Layton, the wife of Lawrence Layton Sr., the mother of Debbie Layton Blakey and Lawrence Layton Jr.
So this is the wife's family we're talking about right here, the woman who marries Dr. Lawrence Layton Sr., the father of all the Laytons, and this is the Philip family, the maiden name of Lisa Layton.
Right. Now, the family was, at the time that they're speaking about, was living, I believe, in Hamburg, Germany, and they say financially, again, in the book In My Father's House, financially, however, the 1920s were good to the Philip family. Again, this is the family of Larry Layton Jr.'s mother's parents. As a stockbroker, Hugo, the mother's father, represented such firms as I.G. Farben and the chemical giant Siemens and Halske. His banking business also flourished, and the family lived well. Now, in and of itself, a fairly innocuous paragraph. The interesting thing, of course, being this early connection with the I.G. Farben chemical combine. Those of you who have listened to some of our other Radio Free America broadcasts, the early ones on the foundations of the Cold War, or Uncle Sam and the Swastika, or some of the other shows dealing with industrialism in the Third Reich, will realize the possible significance of this. I.G. Farben was the German chemical combine that crops up all over the place in the study of post-World War II anti communism, and even pre-World War II anti-communism, and support of fascism. The the international combine known as IG Farben, originally a chemical dye stuff combine, later went into the makings of things such as Zyklon B nerve gas used in the execution chambers of the concentration camps, and a variety of other things that were used by the German army to fight with, and by the German economy to support the German army. IG Farben also was very heavily involved with numerous Western industrial powers, such as Standard Oil, and in many cases, this involvement continued right through the war, in many cases, raising some doubts about the relative loyalty of the Western industrial powers that were indeed still dealing with IG Farben, and were laying open their technical secrets for some rather important things during time of war, such as how to make artificial rubber and things like this, which would be of infinite value to a war effort, especially for Germany, which had no access for most of the war to rubber supplies. Now, the other interesting thing about IG Farben is that by the end of the war, when the IG Farben cartel was more or less broken up, again, as we see so often in these cases, it was not fully broken up, and many parts of it still survive today, such as the Bayer people who make Bayer aspirin, or GAF that make GAF floor tiles, and the GAF Viewmaster that Henry Fonda used to advertise. But although the combine was broken up slightly, the more interesting fact is that several of the important, I suppose the board members and the directors of IG Farben, actually stood trial for war crimes, among the only civilians ever to stand trial for war crimes and be convicted. We've mentioned Otto Ambrose a great deal because he just recently came to the United States at the express behest of a personal friend of President Reagan's, also well-known industrialist who crops up in these things. But so IG Farben was very, very deeply sunken in the business of the Third Reich and was involved in all aspects of the war effort.
Not only that, but it's worth noting that IG Farben, like so many of the key German defense industries and cartels, was very much connected with American business. The Dulles Brothers Law Firm, the prestigious law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, a top Wall Street law firm, handled the legal business of the American subsidiary of IG Farben. IG was a cartel, it was an international monopoly, and had profound and ongoing connections with American business, and it was part of that German-American industrial axis that we've spoken about a great deal on this broadcast, and our Uncle Sam on the station, and our Uncle Sam on the Swastika broadcast. If anybody would like to know more about that, that also is on file, and if somebody would like a copy of that program, they can contact us after the show here.
Okay, so the basic summation then. Again, many of these things at this point crop up only as circumstantial ties, and it is, of course, up to you folks to decide whether there's anything there besides mere circumstance, but we find the mother of Larry Layton and Debbie Layton Blakey coming from a family, where the father worked actively for IG Farben. Of course, IG Farben was a big corporation, but as a big corporation, nonetheless, it still managed to get involved in a lot of nasty things, and that is the first thing to look at in terms of the Layton family.
It's also worth noting that all of the cults or alleged cults that we're going to be dealing with on this broadcast have evidentiary tributaries or connecting links to various aspects of the Axis, of the Japanese, German, and Italian alliance during the Second World War. And they are, this is one of the interesting aspects of these various cults, their intelligence connections, their fascist connections and overtones. These are the things we're going to be looking at the program tonight. And the German origins of Lisa Philipp, now Lisa Layton, or I guess Lisa Layton when she passed away, are not incidental. It's worth noting that Lisa was introduced to her husband, Lawrence Layton Sr., or Lawrence as we'll call him here, by the fellow who she had been dating in Germany, and the same fellow, a German fellow who had also come to the United States, introduced her, well, actually met her when she got off the boat from Germany, and then it was this same fellow who introduced her to Lawrence Layton Sr. And this, so it's an interesting tangle of people, and how coincidental some of this is, well, perhaps you can decide for yourselves, and if we have time for phone-ins at the end, you can perhaps comment on that. An interesting piece of background concerning Lawrence Layton Sr. and his connection to the Philip family, or elements thereof, is also brought out in My Father's House. Reading. Lawrence was preparing for his doctoral examinations when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Fearing that Lawrence would be drafted, Lisa wrote to her father's cousin, Dr. James Franck, F-R-A-N-C-K, the Nobel laureate who was now professor of physics at the University of Chicago. Dr. Franck arranged a predoctoral appointment in physics for Leighton at Chicago. But then Leighton received a student deferment, and he decided to finish his doctoral work at Pennsylvania. If he had gone to Chicago, he discovered later, he would have been working on the Manhattan Project, developing the first atomic bomb. Lisa was horrified when she first learned this. Now, remember Dr. James Franck, the cousin of Lisa Philip, later Lisa Leighton, and his role in looking for a job for Lawrence Leighton. Initially, he was going to go out to Chicago, at the University of Chicago, where he would have been working on the Manhattan Project, the first atomic bomb. Remember that as you listen to the following information.
Yes, it seems that Lawrence Leighton was not to avoid the atomic bomb, no matter how hard he tried. Again, from my father's house, continuing. A little later on in the story, Leighton was also having his troubles at work. It turned out that his boss at Kodak, Dr. Hickman, was interested in ideas that came from one source only, himself. Leighton was coming up with too many suggestions that Hickman thought crossed over into his own private reserve. One sketch sheet that Leighton turned in had to do with thermal diffusion and the purification of chemicals. Leighton didn't know it at the time, but the Manhattan Project had already been set up, and Kodak was involved in it, using a similar process in purifying uranium isotopes at its plant in the remote town of Kingsport, Tennessee. So again, according to the book, that Leighton was not aware of it, but Kodak was indeed working on the Manhattan Project, and Leighton appeared to be doing some work that fairly closely paralleled some activity that Kodak was involved in for the Manhattan Project.
So remember the Manhattan Project connection. Perhaps Lawrence Leighton was not working on it, or perhaps there was an aspect of the project that he was working on with or without his knowledge. It says in this book that he was not aware of the Manhattan Project, although there's a lot of good information in the book. It is written by a member of the Leighton family and is reasonably self-serving. Perhaps nothing more than an interesting coincidence, the fact that initially Lawrence Leighton was to go out to Chicago, where his wife's cousin was going to get him a job on the Manhattan Project. Later, he goes back east to Eastman Kodak, where he's working on, among other things, a chemical diffusion process, which was something very similar to, which, if not identical to, was in fact being used on the Manhattan Project.
One of the reasons that, again, in most cases one would say, well, simply a coincidence, not only the hindsight of what later happened to the Leighton family causes us to scrutinize this a little more closely, but the fact that within 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years after the end of World War II, Lawrence Leighton Sr. would find himself in a very, very prominent position in a rather interesting part of the defense establishment, and later on would also find himself moved to a high position in another part of the defense establishment, and he certainly seemed to have quite a bit of clout for a young man who had been working all unawares for Kodak during World War II without having any connections to any of these people, as we will see.
Good point. Again, this is a speculative note, but very important perhaps in light of Lawrence Leighton's later career, because Lawrence Leighton has many, many connections which go to the innermost sanctums of the national security establishment. Perhaps his most significant appointment for our case, for our purposes here, was when he was named basically chief of research for the biochemistry branch of the Chemical Warfare Division of the U.S. Army at Dugway Proving Ground. Okay? This is mentioned in My Father's House. It reads as follows. Between the Dugway Mountains and the Stansbury Range, 80 miles southwest of Salt Lake City, lies the Dugway Proving Grounds. Like more than half of Utah, the area in prehistoric times was covered by Lake Bonneville. Now the flat, dry lake bed encompasses thousands of square miles. During World War II, Dugway was the testing site for various types of incendiary weapons. Field and laboratory tests of toxic gases and chemicals were also conducted there. When Lawrence Leighton arrived at Dugway in the fall of 1951, his title was Chief Biochemistry Branch, Chemical Warfare Division. As the chief, he directed the work of 8 other chemists and biochemists, a team that performed toxicological and pharmacological investigations of various toxic agents and how these agents affected animals in field tests. The research team also studied the effects of various chemical warfare agents on blood and nerve enzymes. All their work was classified secret or top secret. Remember the work on people and the work studying the effects of various chemicals and toxic agents. 4 months after his arrival, Leighton's responsibilities expanded greatly when he was named chief of the entire Chemical Warfare Division. By the spring of 1952, he was directing all the activities of the division, including the research, development, and testing of all chemical items and toxic agents by the division's 5 branches, analytical chemistry, biological chemistry, organic chemistry, physical chemistry, and the field test branch. According to an unclassified government report, he, quote, was responsible for the publication of 10 classified reports on research aspects of chemical warfare agents and more than 100 reports on chemical weapons systems. So this is a very, very, very important appointment for our purposes here. Perhaps ironic, too, in light of his in-laws' connections to IG Farben, which developed so many of the modern poison gases, including nerve gas, and it's something that should definitely be kept in mind in light of some of the information that we're going to be covering later. So again, remember the connections to the Manhattan Project as you observe the progress of Lawrence Layton up as he moves his way on up through the U.S. National Security Establishment. Here, again, chief of the entire Chemical Warfare Division. Okay, and remember his work testing chemical agents and biological warfare agents.
Okay, now, usually when people in whatever kind of establishment, business establishment or otherwise, they move, they either usually, if they move horizontally, it's usually they move to a different group of people but doing the same kind of thing, or else occasionally if they move to a new discipline, they will start over again a little lower down. However, Lawrence Layton Sr. seems to have been moved to another position of extreme responsibility in a field he was not very familiar with. Reading again from In My Father's House, after almost 2 years at Dugway, Layton decided he had had enough of the proving grounds. For one thing, he could not bring himself to participate in the cliquish backbiting and politicking that went on there. He felt that the post commander was, quote, the most disgusting and arrogant and profane person I'd ever met, unquote. Layton wanted no part of the professional jealousy and paranoia of his colleagues. When a friend from Washington, D.C. visited the Dugway facility, Layton confided his unhappiness, and the friend suggested that he apply for an opening at the Naval Powder Factory, later more accurately named Propellant Facility, at Indian Head, Maryland. Layton arranged for an interview, put in for some vacation time, took a train to Washington, and was immediately offered a job as Associate Director of Research and Development. He didn't feel fully qualified for the position, but working with ballistics, rockets, ICBMs, and the new Vanguard satellite program seemed an interesting challenge. Also, he would be leaving behind the unhealthy politicking at Dugway, and his family would be happy with a move back to Maryland. Okay, so apparently the unhealthy politicking which surrounded him despite the fact that he was basically in charge of the chemical division drove him out of the Dugway Proving Grounds, and he managed to walk into a job as an associate director of research at the Propellant Facility at Indian Head, Maryland, again working right squarely, and this is a man who during World War II was essentially an apprentice working for Kodak, and 7, 8, 9 years after World War II he's already become head of chemical warfare research, and then an associate director of research for IBM's, ICBM's ballistic missiles, rockets, and the Vanguard satellite program. So a man who definitely has a rising star.
Alrighty, now recall that in the first program that we dealt with Jones, and in the second part of our series about mind control, we examined the possibility that Jonestown may have been an extension of some of the CIA and military's mind control programs. Here, what we're really asking you to consider is simply some of the contradictions in the official story of Jonestown, in particular, the official story with regard to the bodies. Initially, there were reports of 1,100 passports of People's Temple members who went down to Jonestown. Then about 150 to 200 of them simply vanished from the news. All of a sudden, they began talking about 900. For the first 5 days or so of the after the massacre, the press reports simply talked about 400 bodies. After about 5 days of looking for the other missing 500 people, no word about the 200 who were lopped off at the beginning, all of a sudden, the press reported that, by golly, here were the other 500 bodies. They were under the first 400 all along, and they just hadn't noticed it. They said there were a great many children who were had been murdered and were lying underneath the bodies. This in spite of the fact that the bodies had been were in the process of being turned over and identified to the extent that they could this entire time. Now that this is one of the aspects of the Jonestown situation that has elicited a great deal of curiosity from people in the past. A lot of people have expressed grave reservations as to how that could possibly have happened. Now remember Lawrence Layton Sr.'s work in testing chemical and biological agents at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. And think about some of the anomalies in the official story. I'd like to read you a short section now from a book called The Children of Jonestown. That was authored by Kenneth Wooden, W-O-O-D-E-N, published in softcover by McGraw-Hill and copyrighted 1981. Wooden's also the author of a very famous book about disturbed orphans and attempts to find foster homes for them called Weeping in the Playtime of Others. And Wooden did some work about the many children who were at Jonestown, and I'd like to read you a short section of that here. Wooden writes in The Children of Jonestown, "Initially, the United States and Guyana agreed that the 400 known bodies were to be buried at Jonestown. But as the body count rose day by day, so did Prime Minister Burnham's concern that his country would become a cult shrine. He told the U.S. Embassy that the dead Americans had to be removed at once. The United States military was quickly mobilized, and within several days of Dr. Moto's arrival, he was the chief medical examiner of Guyana, was on the scene to start the grim task of removing the bodies. The first chore of the troops was to bayonet the bloated bodies to release the internal gases caused by the hot sun and high humidity. The second was more controversial. Although Ordell Rhodes and Stanley Clayton had returned to the compound the first morning to help identify the dead, quote, on orders from very high up, all politically sensitive papers and forms of identification were removed from the corpses." I'm going to read that sentence again. "Although Ordell Rhodes and Stanley Clayton had returned to the compound the first morning to help identify the dead, quote, on orders from very high up, all politically sensitive papers and forms of identification were removed from the corpses," unquote. Photos on the cover of Newsweek and other magazines and newspapers clearly show that many of the bodies had ID tags on them. Joel Cobb and John Stone, who are now among the unidentified children, were initially positively identified. Jim Cobb told NBC News in March of 1979, quote, "My brother, Johnny Cobb, saw tags on the people's bodies, and only two members of my family have been identified, and I want to know why," unquote. Lieutenant General Gordon Sumner later was reported to have said, quote, "It was the first time in his military career that he saw his men politicized," unquote. In view of the fact that the order to strip the IDs came from Robert Pastor, P-A-S-T-O-R, of the staff of Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, it is clear that the impulse was to save any possible embarrassment to the Carter administration. This action would, in many cases, make the process of identification impossible for the medical authorities in Guyana, and once the bodies had been returned to the United States. Dr. Rudiger Breitenecker, B-R-E-I-T-E-N-E-C-K-E-R, a Baltimore pathologist, said that the seven autopsies of which he assisted, quote, were severely hampered by lack of crucial information, which is usually collected in medical legal investigations, unquote. Unaware of the stripping of the bodies and uninformed of Dr. Moto's work and findings, the United States pathologists naively told the New York Times on February 18, 1979, quote, "We shuddered about the degree of ineptness," unquote. Preparing the children for removal from Jonestown to the United States was no easy task for the GIs assigned to the duty. In fact, the Army and Air Force are quietly providing psychiatric help to many of the young soldiers and airmen who assisted in the removal of the bodies from Jonestown. Well, there's a lot of things to mention in this passage I just read. First of all, why would the ID tags be cut off the bodies? In particular, why would the orders come down from a top advisor on the staff of Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, to remove the body, remove the tags from the bodies? And indeed, then, what is the, you know, how can you account for the discrepancy in the casualty figures reported from Jonestown? It seems unlikely that 500 bodies could have been hidden under the first 400 all along while people were attempting to identify them. And the question is, was there any relation, this is simply speculation, was there any relationship between some of the types of work that Dr. Lawrence Layton in the past was doing and Jonestown? Were these people in any way being used for experimentation? Was this a form of covert operation? And again, remember Dr. Lawrence Layton's work testing toxins at Dugway Proving Ground. Remember the connections to I.G. Farben, and remember Dr. Lawrence Layton's many, many connections to various aspects of the U.S. national security establishment. Again, we're not saying that we have the absolute answer here. What we're saying is that the facts as they are given are not only don't make sense, but are in all probability impossible, and that something appears to be rotten in Denmark, and we're saying what, where, and why were the ID tags cut off.
One also wants to at least raise an eyebrow and look curiously at the Army and Air Force psychiatrists that have been brought in to help the soldiers who were involved in stripping the ID tags and so hopelessly confusing the identification that to this day, as far as I know, quite a few bodies remain unidentified from Jonestown, what kind of psychiatric help they're getting. Of course, one of the results of the stripping of the identification from these bodies and some of the other things that have gone on is that to this day nobody has been able to develop any kind of a clear picture of who was where when, which of course when you're trying to put together information on this kind of scene afterwards is the kind of thing that's vitally important to get timelines going, positioning, and to show the ebb and flow of people in and out of the Jonestown compound in the first place. So basically what has been done by the removal of those ID tags, not just to render the bodies of the people who died at Jonestown nameless, but in many cases also to so completely confuse any investigation that might go on as to make it virtually impossible to put anything concrete together.
A couple of quick points. Now, remember, we've come across Zbigniew Brzezinski in the past. He is a Polish native who was a professor at Columbia University in New York. He then went on to become President Carter's National Security Advisor. Now, in our Radio Free America show about Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi intelligence chief who jumped to the United States with his entire Eastern Front and organization, we took a look at the curious circumstances by which a fellow named Valerian Trifa, a Gehlen agent, a Romanian Nazi, a war criminal, came to address came to speak over the Romanian language service of Radio Free Europe on May Day of 1979, and we took a look at the fact that his hiring by Radio Free Europe and the subsequent firing of employees who were critical of this Nazis being hired to address Romania were basically the people responsible for hiring Trifa were part of a circle of friends which included Zbigniew Brzezinski, the key names there, Noel Bernard, head of the Romanian language service, and a fellow named Paul Henze, longtime CIA operative, former colleague of Brzezinski's at Radio Free Europe, which recall was started by Reinhard Gehlen. We mentioned that in our Radio Free America series about Gehlen. And it's worth noting that Hens has been very active with the thesis, been in publicizing the assertion that the KGB shot the Pope, which we've devoted a major block of time here on KFJC to putting it down. One last note here before we leave the People's Temple, and I would say you can probably figure at some point we'll do an entire Radio Free America show about the People's Temple, because they're tremendous. It's a tremendous issue, and we haven't covered all of it. If you think that all of our speculation about the Leighton family possibly being involved in some sort of intrigue or skullduggery is pure poppycock, take note of this particular incident in the Leighton family shortly after Lawrence Leighton received his appointment to Dugway. Again, reading from In My Father's House. On May 10th, 1952, just 2 months after Leighton was named Chief of the Chemical Warfare Division, Anita Phillip, that's the mother of Lisa Leighton, Anita Phillip committed suicide by jumping from the window of her New York apartment. The suicide note she left behind was written in German and translates roughly as follows. Quote, "My friends, know that I, free and proper, am a good American, but I was a gossip and have been entangled in a network of intrigue. I no longer have the strength to free myself from it. Forget me not, my beloved children and family, and you, Hugo, forgive me." Hugo, recall, is the father of Lisa Leighton, the lawyer for I.G. Farben. "Live well. All of you loved mankind so well." She signed the note with a single letter A. She was 61 years old. So apparently somebody was noting a pattern of intrigue involving the Leighton Phillip axis some time before. So again, if this seems a little far-fetched to you, if it seems like we're clutching at straws, well, apparently that was more than Anita Phillip had to clutch as she fell from that window. So keep that in mind.
Okay, no talk about cults and cults related to political activity would be complete without the introduction of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon and his Unification Church. Sun Myung Moon and the Unification Church, otherwise known as the Moonies to most people, have become a very prominent part of the political scene, and indeed their political influence is increasing all the time in the United States and in the Americas in general. We've talked in the past about them to a large extent. We've talked about their origins, which we'll go back over tonight to a small extent, and we've talked about many of their activities. Some of you, of course, are aware of these activities. They're very heavily involved politically in a number of Latin American countries. Their political arm, Causa, is currently getting money to the anti-Sandinista rebels and to various right-wing governments all over Central and South America to put down internal revolutionary movements and things of that nature. People in Uruguay are talking about the fact that the Moonies have $50 million invested in Uruguay and they only have 3 members in that particular country. So the Moonies have been getting around. Here in the United States, of course, they've been publishing a newspaper called the Washington Times, from which the editor, himself a staunch conservative, just recently quit because he said the paper was being too completely controlled by the Moonies. And the Washington Times is a glossy little newspaper that basically is running the arch-conservative party line and is getting nationwide distribution right now. There have been numerous other allegations of things that the Moonies have been involved in that we don't really have time to go into right now, but just to give you, that's just to give you a general idea, they're very much involved with a lot of things in the political world right now.
We're going to cover some of the many bases that the Moonies touched during the course of the broadcast. Before we actually get into the Moonies themselves, it might be worth mentioning where our information, or most of the information we're talking about, we're going to present to you this evening comes. Most of the information we're going to present about the Unification Church comes from a great book called Gifts of Deceit, subtitled Sun Myung-moon, Tongsun Park, and the Korean Scandal. It was authored by Robert Boetcher, or Boetcher, B-O-E-T-T-C-H-E-R, with Gordon L. Friedman, F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N. Let me read you a little bit about Mr. Boetcher. As staff director of the House Subcommittee on Internal Relations, Robert Boetcher was in on the Korean scandal from the beginning. It was the investigations done by his staff that led directly to the breaking of that scandal. His work put him in liaison with top officials in the CIA and in the Departments of State and Justice, as well as with Special Counsel Leon Jaworski and the staff and principals of the Ethics Committee investigation. Fluent in 2 Far Eastern languages and with an MS in International Relations from Georgetown University, Mr. Boetcher served 5 years as a Foreign Service officer with a specialty in Far Eastern affairs before joining Congressman Donald Fraser's staff in 1971. So that's the source of our information. Gifts of Deceit, published in hardcover by Holt Reinhardt and Winston, copyrighted 1980. And we'll tell you a little bit about what happened to Mr. Boetcher after he wrote the book, after we've talked about People's Temple.
Okay, starting with some information about what it is that Sun Myung-moon believes, and or at least what he professes to believe as he leads his church.
Now, remember, as you're listening to what the Moonies actually think, just remember all the people selling the flowers along the El Camino and all the places you run into the Moonies, and they may look real nice smiling and waving these flowers around. Consider, as you listen to the stuff that Nip and I are about to read you, consider what the Moonies actually believe.
And also, again, don't get so caught up in the mythology of the thing as to forget that these people are taking a very active political role, whether or not their particular religion is the source of it, or there are direct political motives that the religion is a cover-up for. Again, that's a question that we're not capable of answering tonight, but anyway, you will have some more information we hope to make that decision with. Again, from Gifts of Deceit, this is the beginning of a chapter, and the chapter is entitled The Lord of the Second Advent. Sun Myung-moon leaves no room for doubt about where he and Korea stand in the eyes of God. He is the new Messiah, and Korea is God's chosen nation. This is the culmination of God's 6,000-year quest to restore man from the fall of Adam. It was revealed to him by God when he was a young man, Moon tells his cult followers. God said, quote, "You are the son I have been seeking, the one who can begin my eternal history." Moon felt no humility. After all, it was God's will to choose him after an exhaustive search through thousands of years and billions of lives. The title Son of God could go to only the rarest of individuals, he says, one capable of winning victory over all human history. He was proud to inherit God's kingdom. Moon's theology, the divine principle, teaches that man can be restored to original goodness by restoring Adam, Eve, and 3 archangels. Adam's fall resulted from Eve's being seduced by the archangel Lucifer, who was jealous because God gave Eve to Adam instead of to him. Human history has been a constant replay of the same interaction among Adams, Eves, and archangels. God's eternal plan for man's perfection has been thwarted, as potential Adams are undone by Eves and archangels. The positions of Adam, Eve, and the archangels are occupied by persons, nations, and movements identified as such by Moon. Ultimately, Adam must dominate after successfully going through three stages: formation, growth, and perfection. But if an Eve or an archangel is at a higher stage than Adam, they must help restore Adam to perfection so he can assume his rightful role in the unified system of things. Moon is perfect Adam, so he must be obeyed without question. Jesus, the most important Adam between the original one and Moon, attained spiritual perfection but was a flawed Messiah. His mission was foredoomed by John the Baptist, who spent his time baptizing people instead of becoming Jesus' obedient disciple for influencing the politics of the Herod regime. Just to insert again, since we're getting into this very deeply, just to remind you folks, this is somebody else's theology we're reading. This is the theology of the Unification Church as laid out by Sun Myung Moon, just in case anybody's just turning the radio on. Also note that last phrase. He claims that Jesus' messiahhood was flawed because he let John the Baptist baptize people instead of helping him to influence the politics of the Herod regime. Making things worse, Jesus was a child of adultery, not immaculate conception, according to Moon. Mary was impregnated by Zechariah. Jesus had an unhappy home life because Joseph was jealous of Zechariah and resented Jesus. The divine principle, therefore, teaches family unity as dictated by Moon. When Jesus grew up, he failed as a leader because he was unable to love his disciples enough to motivate them to kill for him or die in his place. Moonies are taught that because Moon's love is not of the weak Jesus kind, their love for Moon must be strong enough to do what Jesus' disciples were unprepared to do. Since Jesus was incapable of perfect love, owing to his unwholesome upbringing, he was also unable to marry, as intended by God. Quote, "The reason why Jesus died was because he couldn't have a bride. Because there was no preparation of bride to receive Jesus, that was the cause of his death," Moon preaches. Political action is central to Moon's mission, although the cult denies that it engages in politics at all. Moon views Jesus' failure as a political failure for not gaining control of the government of Israel. Jesus was able to establish a spiritual kingdom, but that was only half of what God wanted. Moon is taking up where Jesus left off by uniting the spiritual kingdom with a physical kingdom on earth. The trouble with Christians, he says, is that they have accepted the myth that the Messiah will return as a spirit, quote, on the clouds. To Moon, it is obvious that if this were true, God would have made it happen long ago. The long delay was necessary because God intended for the Lord of the Second Advent to appear as a person who will complete Jesus' mission on earth among the living. He sees Christian churches as furthering Satan's cause by rejecting him.
Continuing with gifts of deceit. Israel was God's chosen nation, but the Jews, falling prey to Satan's power, rejected Jesus. God punished them with centuries of suffering and finally cleansed them by killing 6 million in World War II. Note that interesting interpretation of the Holocaust. But the Jews had missed their chance. God had to find a new Messiah and a new Adam nation because, Moon explains, it is God's principle not to use the same people in the same territory twice. Korea was ideally suited for several reasons. It is a peninsula physically resembling the male. Like the Italian peninsula, cultures of islands and continents can mingle there to form a unified civilization corresponding to the Roman Empire. Korea had maintained its own cultural identity through invasions by China and Japan over the centuries. And at Panmunjom, the military demarcation line represents the division not only between the communist and non-communist worlds, but God and Satan as well. Japan is in the position of Eve. Being only an island country, it cannot be Adam. It yearns for male-like, peninsular Korea on the mainland. Moon sees the Japanese generally as effeminate people who want to be dominated by stronger, manly powers. But as Eve prevailed over Adam in the fall, Japan prevailed over Korea in the colonial period. And like Eve in the fall, Japan became a satanic power. America is an archangel country. Its mother is England, another island country in the position of Eve. The Archangel America helped the Atom Country Korea by sending Christian missionaries, rescuing it from Japanese rule and stopping the advance of Satan's Atom, Communist North Korea. America is too arrogant and individualistic, however. It cannot remain the world's leader because God has destined America to serve Korea. Korea's mission, therefore, is to restore the Eve country Japan and the Archangel America and become the center of the new unified world civilization. This is to be accomplished through Moon and his Unification Church. In Moon's unification thought, politics cannot be separated from religion. His political views have been conditioned narrowly by South Korea's two prevailing political phenomena during his lifetime, nationalism and anti-communism. What he sees as politically imperative for Korea, he has applied to all of God's universe. World history is now centered on Korea, he preaches, and what happens to Korea centers on him. He claims the Korean War could have been avoided had he been accepted as the Lord of the Second Advent. The Archangel America had created the right conditions by making Korea independent from the Eve country Japan. But the Koreans, failing to rally around Moon, were divided between communist and free world forces. Though tragic, the division carried forward God's plan that Korea be the flag bearer for the world. The battlefield for the showdown between God and Satan would be Korea. God's chosen people would triumph through suffering. America, Japan, and all other nations could be restored by helping Korea's anti-communist cause. Only in Korea could the civilizations of East and West be unified. In the end, Moon declares, even North Korea's Kim Il-sung could be restored if he answered the call to follow the divine principle. Details about Moon's early life. Now, note Moon's beginnings here before we proceed into this. Details about Moon's early life are not clear because of his efforts to tell the story himself only in terms of being the son of God. He was born in 1920 in North Korea. He was raised as a Presbyterian in a middle-class family and was a good student and studied engineering at a university in Japan during World War II. So Moon is in Japan during the Second World War. He was married in 1944 and divorced in 1950. He was arrested twice by the communist government in North Korea for activities as an evangelist and was sentenced to 5 years in prison in the fall of 1947. During the Korean War, when the United Nations forces reached Hung Nam Prison, he was released halfway through his sentence. He resumed his evangelical activities in Busan on the southeastern coast. With a small handful of followers in Seoul, he founded the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity, which became known as the Unification Church in 1954. So, remember that Reverend Moon is in Japan during World War II, when, of course, the United States is fighting Japan. Recall also that Korea was a Japanese colony. It had originally been a Russian colony. However, after the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, Japan assumed stewardship over Korea, which she held until the end of the Second World War in 1945.
Just want to mention also that you're listening to KFJC, Los Altos Hills. A couple of other points to be made very quickly. Also, for those who are familiar with the history of the time, they will be aware that in Korea, the...